You are listening to This Week in Palestine. I'm your host, Ann Lucas. Sabah al-khair, masa' al-khair, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, and I am your host, Ann Lucas. There are a few newer podcasts on the activist scene I've been wanting to share with you in case you missed them. One of them was What Have We Learned, and I shared that one a couple of weeks ago. But this week, I am thrilled to share the Samud podcast with you. The Samud podcast has two amazing Palestinian hosts, Zaina Ashrawi Hutchinson, who is a Jerusalem-born Palestinian, and Dr. Ed Hassan, a Palestinian-American activist. This episode of their work I'm sharing with you on this show dropped on January 23rd, 2025. And I'm so happy it's an interview with Diana Bhutu. Yes, the Diana Bhutu. We've shared Diana's recent work before. She is part of the Institute for Middle East Understanding, and we've shared her interviewing other people for that organization's podcast. But Diana is so much more than a journalist who interviews people. She actually gave up living in Canada full-time to live in Haifa, Palestine. And she became a spokesperson for the PLO back in the day. From that position, she famously became the only woman to take part in the negotiations to end the Second Intifada in the early aughts. These days, she's a consummate activist for Free Palestine 24/7. No matter where she is or what's going on, she is out there speaking up all over the place for Palestine. And if you've seen her, you know, you can tell, she's been a negotiator for Palestine in high-stakes settings with Zionists. She is very quick on her feet, and she can make multiple points without taking a breath when she is arguing with Zionists. The speed and clarity she can speak with when needed is absolutely amazing. Of course, Diana speaking with two other Palestinians is a safe space, so we can get to hear a more calm, reflective Diana on the Samud pod. And the interview focuses first and foremost on Diana's life's journey and experiences as a Palestinian, before moving on to the current moment in Gaza and the West Bank. To say Diana Bhutu has lived an interesting life is an understatement. I have followed Diana's work for ages, but I'm not sure even I knew all the things she tells us about herself in this interview. And listening to three Palestinians talk about it gives us non-Palestinian allies a real insight into the variety of life journeys different Palestinians have. The variety of physical, mental, and spiritual journeys Palestinians take in their lives is hard for me to keep in focus, and it's really rare that I get a perspective-building opportunity like this interview to ground myself in that reality. And on top of that, I found it to be an insightful and enjoyable listen, and I think you will too. We really do have so much to listen to. So yalla bina, let's go. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Whatever time zone you're living in, it's time for some mood. All about humanity, so this right here for everyone. Uplift, amplify, empower everyone. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Whatever time zone you're living in, it's time for some mood. On this episode of the Samud podcast, we uplift, empower, and amplify Palestinian-Canadian Diana Bhutu. Diana is a distinguished lawyer with expertise in international human rights law. She made history as the only woman negotiator during the Second Intifada, advising Palestinian leadership for 5 years. Her pivotal work in a landmark case before the International Court of Justice led to the ruling that Israel's occupation wall violated international law.
We are your hosts, Ed Hassan and Zaina Ashrawi. Please don't forget to subscribe to this podcast wherever you watch or listen, and follow us on social media, either at Samud Pod or at Samud Podcast. Welcome, Diana. It's so wonderful to have you. Thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you both. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. We really enjoy watching everything that you're doing and all of your feedback. I follow you on X and all of your insightful information that you provide us. I do want to ask, I know that you were born in Canada, but your parents were born in Palestine. Your father was a Nakba survivor. Can you go a little bit over your family history and that experience?
So both of my parents were born in Palestine, and both of them were born before the creation of the State of Israel. My father was born in Nazareth, but raised in a town just outside of Nazareth called Limjedil. Limjedil was destroyed in 1948 during the Nakba. My father's family fled in 1948. He was nine at the time. And they fled to Nazareth, and then from Nazareth to Lebanon, from Lebanon to Syria, from Syria to Jordan. And then they snuck themselves back in, I believe it was 1950 or 1951. So they were some of the 20,000 who snuck themselves back in after Israel was created. My mother was born in Nazareth and raised in Nazareth. Her family did not flee. But both of them ended up having their lives very much shaped by the Nakba. My father, his family was forever changed because his family was split. His own sister, my own aunt, ended up fleeing Palestine and ended up living and unfortunately dying in a refugee camp in Jordan, even though she was born in Palestine, raised in Palestine, married in Palestine, gave birth to her first child in Palestine. She ended up dying in a refugee camp in Jordan, never able to reunite with my father. And my father's family was split in terms of his cousins and uncles, etc. So he lived his whole life with the effects of the Nakba as a child. Both of my parents were shaped by the Nakba because they both lived under Israeli military rule. From the period of 1948 until 1966, Israel maintained a system of military rule that actually ended up serving as the blueprint for what they're currently doing in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, requiring, for example, that people have special permits to be able to travel, cutting each other off from one another, using the military system to expropriate land. And so both of them were very much shaped by the Nakba and the fact that they had to live as, I don't even know if it's second-class citizens, I don't know what the terminology is, as a fifth column, treated as a fifth column in a state that actively sought to get rid of them as it continues to actively seek to get rid of others. There was a tragedy in my father's family, which is what led me to be born in Canada. This is what led my parents to move to Canada. And that is in Purim, 1965. Purim is a Jewish holiday in which, by and large, people get drunk. They dress up as like akin to Halloween, different, but I'm just drawing the analogy. And my father's youngest brother, my uncle, was walking to school one day, and it was the day after Purim, and he was struck by a Jewish Israeli drunk driver and killed. My father tried to seek justice for the killing of his brother. He demanded to know who the driver was. He wanted to see that the so-called Israeli court system was going to prosecute this man for killing his youngest brother. But instead, they let the drunk driver free. My father was the one who ended up paying the price, with everything from having his permits revoked to being threatened with prison. It was then that my father, who was newly married at the time, said to my mother, "We're not going to live here any longer. We're not going to live as second-class citizens in our own homeland." It was a very painful decision for my father, because even though he had been living under the system of military rule, unable to go back to the town that the Israelis destroyed, Lemjedel, when they came back in 1951, there was still something in him that wanted to remain in Palestine. And he understood that remaining was very vital. And yet, after his brother was killed, he couldn't take it any longer. And that's why he and my mother ended up moving to Canada.
You moved to Canada, but did you feel like a second-class citizen or whatever in Canada as well?
It's a hard question for me to answer, because growing up, my parents did everything possible to try to shield us from the pain of everything, from the pain of the Nakba, the pain of living under Israeli military rule, the pain of my uncle, my father's brother, being killed, the pain of being separated from family. And so they did everything possible to try to highlight to us just how good it was, but just to make us feel as though you don't have this evil system that is crushing you at every moment. And it was only when I got a little bit older and was able to understand race and racism that I realized that they were doing this as an act of love in order to preserve us. And then I realized just how deeply racist Canada and North America is in general. The similarities between what Canada has done to the indigenous population and what Israel continues to do to Palestinians. As a small child, I didn't feel it, but it was once I became aware and once I started to see the ways in which people talked about Palestinians, the ways in which my own school teachers tried to educate us on Palestine, that's when I began to feel the real racism of it.
You talked a little bit about their experience and then trying to shield you, but did they talk to you about their own experiences in detail growing up, instilling in you that you're Palestinian, pride in Palestine, or was it more of a survival mode now that we've left and dealing with the trauma as well?
It was a mix of both. So they didn't really go through everything about Palestine because I think they wanted to shield us. I have two other sisters. But at the same time, they were definitely proud of being Palestinian. This is going to sound silly now because I'm so much older. But at the time, they used to talk about Nazareth. And Nazareth was this like magical, mythical city for us. The food tasted better. The people were kinder. The smells were different. Houses were built differently, magical and mythical at the same time. Jesus was from there, right? I definitely knew that I was from this magical, mythical city. And yet going beyond that was not something that they really went into, I think in large part because they wanted to protect us. So I actually didn't know about my father's family fleeing in 1948 until I was about 16 or 17 years old. I chalk that up to my own arrogance, by the way. I beat myself up over it now because I think, why wasn't I asking the questions? Why wasn't I interested? Why wasn't I more inquisitive?
I guess it's hard to ask the questions when you don't know what to ask at that point. Generational trauma that they experience, and then it's self-preservation and preservation of the family. It's the way of life for Palestinians.
Absolutely.
So as you became more aware of your Palestinianness, if you will, and owning it, were you more vocal in school? Did you face discrimination in school because of it, or growing up in general with your friends? Were there any other Palestinian families around you in Canada?
There were Palestinian families, but not in the school that I went to and not in the area in which I lived. So we definitely had family friends who were Palestinian, but they didn't have children or their children were a lot younger. But in school, that's when the problems began to happen. I remember very distinctly one of my teachers saying, there's no such thing as Palestine. I remember being taught about Arabs as though we lived in tents. I remember saying to him, why does he think that we live in tents? Why does he think that this is what our existence was? And then having to push back against teachers, when I'd say my parents were born in Nazareth, they'd say, oh, you mean Israel? And I'd say, no, not Israel. And that's hard. You both know this. That's hard when you're a kid to be confronting the adults, to be confronting the people from whom you're supposed to be learning and trying to correct them. That's not easy. And so for me, I was taking inspiration, Zaina, you'll know this, from your mom, who really paved the way for people of my generation and other generations as well, because she so eloquently spoke and speaks about Palestine and about her lived experience and gave us that permission to talk about our lived experiences. So for me, the shift came mostly when I was in university, when I was no longer feeling the weight of the adult and the weight of the parent, but also being able to see that there were other role models who were out there who were doing the speaking and who were writing. People like Leila Khaled, whose book was and is incredible. People like Hassan Kanafani. Other writers like Edward Said, Fawzi Al-Asmar, Sabri Jirias. And there were just so many, Darwish obviously, who had and have that ability to convey what their lived experience was like.
I read somewhere that the first Intifada was this pivotal moment in your life or a turning point in your life. Is that where you decided, you know what, I'm going to step up here, I'm going to learn more and take action?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I was young. And the first Intifada was, you'll see there's a theme in my life, which is Intifadas. By chance, I ended up visiting Palestine the day that the Intifada started. The day the first Intifada started, yeah. And I moved here the day the second Intifada started. So that's why I said there's a theme. So at the time, my late grandmother, who was another really very instrumental figure in my life, she'd come to visit us in Canada for 6 months. At the end of the 6 months, she said, Nazareth is just so much better. I miss my plants. I miss my house. I miss the food. I miss everything. I remember being astonished by this. Really? Again, I was a kid, teenager. And then I missed her. So over the Christmas break, I asked my parents if I could go visit her. And so my older sister and I went to Nazareth, and we ended up arriving at the start of the First Intifada. And so that moment was really, it shaped me because first, I didn't speak Arabic very well, I have to say. I'm very embarrassed by it. But just the things that I was seeing, the protests, and then there were a lot of things that didn't really make sense for me as a kid. For example, Nazareth was very crowded. It's built on top of one another. The roads are dilapidated, or they were back then. There were no parks. And then just a couple of kilometers away in Upper Nazareth, it's called Nazareth Elite. The name has since changed, but anyway, that was the name at the time. It looked exactly like a suburb of Toronto. I remember asking people, like, why does Nazareth Elite look like this? And why does Nazareth look the way that it does? And nobody could really explain. I think they did. I just didn't understand the language. But I wasn't getting it. And it was enough of me being able to see what I was seeing, attending protests. My family was going to the protests that were in Nazareth at the time, going to Jerusalem, and then being left with so many questions. It's what then caused me to want to learn more. And again, I beat myself up over it all the time and saying, why wasn't I asking the questions? And why didn't I know more sooner?
I always say this, it's by design. They want us to be fragmented and all over the world and not know our history and not know our stories. But one way or another, Palestinians, our stories comes up. Our stories definitely come up because you cannot take away Palestinians from Palestine. You can't take away Palestine from Palestinians, right? We are who we are. So you were saying that you initially went back in the First Intifada and you were mostly in Nazareth, Meshaik. Did you travel around the West Bank as well, the rest of Palestine?
In that year, 87, we traveled around everywhere, but in terms of the West Bank, we went to Ramallah and obviously to Jerusalem. And I remember my father calling my cousin. Some things that people may not know is that just in the same way that there weren't a whole ton of phones in the West Bank, there weren't a lot of phones that were given to Palestinians in Israel either. So we had to arrange to go to speak to my parents. We had arranged for a certain time, be at the phone at such and such a time. And I remember my father saying to my family and then to me, be careful, don't go to the West Bank. Be careful, don't go to the West Bank. And I didn't know what that was. Again, I was ignorant. I didn't know what he was talking about. And so then when they did take me to Nazareth, one of my cousins said, don't tell your father that we went to the West Bank. I went, okay. But we did go around. We went to Haifa, Akya, Tabariya, Yafa, Walid, Ramle, Al-Quds, where else? Gosh. Oh, we did go to Jenin.
You mentioned your Arabic wasn't strong. I'm just not saying that. I'm horrible at Arabic, but wow, you're way above me. So I don't know what you mean there.
I learned. So after I came back, I'm telling you, I felt totally ignorant. And everything from not understanding the way Nazareth Elite looks the way it is versus Nazareth, to not understanding protests, to not understanding what the Intifada was about, to not understanding what I was seeing on television, I actually said, that's it, I have to learn Arabic. I'm fluent now. It took some years, I have to say. It's not an easy language.
Talk about your second time. If I'm not mistaken, you were asked to be a part of the negotiation team several times. You said no the first time because you thought maybe you were too junior.
Yeah.
Correct. You eventually ended up moving to the West Bank. Talk about that culture shock, because coming from Canada, moving to the West Bank, the game is completely different, obviously. What was your initial reaction when you got there?
There was no shock because the first time around, yes, I said no, and I went to continue my studies. I was studying in California at the time. But throughout that period, I was going to the West Bank a lot. From the 90s onward, I would go to visit practically every year or every 18 months, which is how my Arabic got better. Every place from Nazareth to the cities in the West Bank. So I actually spent a few months in Ramallah one summer. I spent a summer working at Al-Haq. And so it wasn't really a shock for me. when I moved there in 2000. I was on a flight for 18 hours from California to Mottar Lid, the Lid airport, when the Intifada breaks out. So I had no clue when I landed what had happened, what was transpiring. And so the shock came as I got a car to go from the airport into Ramallah. And when I got into Ramallah and then seeing the protests that were happening, and then within a couple of days, the Israelis ended up hitting a site just behind where I was staying. And then they hit the police station when they bombed the police station. So that was the shock. I had lived for a while exposed to Israeli violence, but I made a huge mistake, which is I was one of these people who just thought that all of it was going to disappear somehow. And I discounted it and would say, oh no, that'll just go away. It'll go away. It'll go away. But the real shock was just seeing not the everyday violence, but just the brutal violence. That was within my first week, the first day to first week. That was the part that was very shocking.
Yeah, I just want to offer a compliment here. They asked you one time to join the negotiation team and you said no because you didn't feel you were ready. That's just so much humility right there. I think most of us would be like, sure, we'll just go wing it and figure it out and do it. And you're like, no, I'm not ready. That's amazing to me.
The second time around, the only reason I went was because two mentors, one of whom unfortunately has passed away, said, just think of it as like a year, just try it out for a year. And I remember thinking, I can't, that's too much. And they were just so insistent, worst case scenario, you lose a year. That wasn't the worst case scenario. But anyway, I remember being very hesitant and it took some, anyway, I don't regret it.
How did they find you or how did they reach out to you? What was the connection?
In the mid-90s, I had spent some time working for Al-Haq. I'd been a researcher for a summer working at Al-Haq. And then once the negotiations had begun, they were looking for people who had some experience, who knew Arabic, and who understood the context. So it was the people from Al-Haq coupled with a few mentors that I had who suggested my name. And that's how they found me.
Gotcha. And what was that feeling about, I think you were the first woman negotiator, right, ever. Did you feel the pressure there?
It was, I don't know how to describe it. It wasn't pressure. It was more of a mixed bag. On the one hand, we had people who, again, Dr. Hadar Ashrawi, who had paved the way on so many things. But for me, it was different because I was coming in this legal capacity as a lawyer. And they tended to look towards the men as being like the ones who had knowledge. But I don't want to make it out just like that. There was also a flip side, which is that sometimes it opened doors. It wasn't just, oh, you're like a nice woman and thank you very much. And oh, how amazing that you're qualified. There were times that things were opened as well. Look, I think any society around the world, or the ones that I know at least, are male dominant. And there's a lot of patriarchy and a lot of misogyny. We shouldn't discount that. And we shouldn't exceptionalize Palestine. In fact, in some ways, it was just that much better. In Canada, I was the first woman to work for a certain judge. And that was actually a much worse experience.
Diana, I'm really interested in that political phase of your life. At the time, the PA had just come in. Everything was brand new. People were still getting used to, at least in the West Bank, living without having soldiers around with guns in our faces 24/7. They're still there, but now in the periphery. What was the sentiment outside of the negotiations, in the streets with regards to the negotiations? And how ridiculous were the negotiations on the inside? I know this is a loaded question and has so many different answers. I think the conversation has changed so much over the years. I remember the feedback back then and what we now know is the result of it. How was it on the outside versus the inside?
I can't speak to what it was like before because I didn't live there. You did. And so I don't know what that terror is like to live with them on a daily basis and see the soldiers and see their guns and see their brutality. I live in Haifa and I can talk a lot about that side of it, but I didn't know what it was like before. I think there's a few things. So first is when I got there, there was still a little bit of Oslo euphoria. I might be overplaying it, but I think we do a disservice if we just somehow say that everybody knew that Oslo was wrong. I don't think that was the case. There were people who were supportive of Oslo. It diminished over time, obviously, but there was an initial sense of, we need to try. We need to try. And so when I arrived, there was still some of that. The first time I lived there was 1996, and that's when it became clear what Israel was doing. There were just settlements popping up all over the place. And I remember every week, because I used to take a taxi to go from Ramallah to either Nablus or straight to Jenin, and then from Jenin, you'd have to take a separate taxi. You could still do that. And I remember that every week, the drivers would tell me, oh, there's a new road that's popped up, but we can't go on it. Oh, there's a new road, but it's inaccessible, because these were the bypass roads, the Israeli bypass roads that Israel was constructing. These are roads that are built for settlers or for Israeli cars, and Palestinians are forbidden from going on these roads. And so that was happening each and every week. So the time that I got there, it was a mix of people still wanting to be optimistic, but then the settlement project in straight up overdrive and the construction of the roads in overdrive. And on the outside, there was a sense of there's something happening and we hope it happens soon, but also a realization that Israel was going nuts. Israel was going nuts in terms of the settlement construction expansion. And then on the inside, now remember, I started in 2000. So this is now fast forward 4 years. On the inside, gosh, that's a whole other conversation. What were the negotiations like? It was, I don't know how to put this politely.
We don't want polite. It's okay.
I'm trying to think of a way to put it that's not so jarring. But it was like being beaten every day, right? It's like somebody is hitting you over the head day in and day out, day in and day out, and saying, sign, sign. And you're just like trying to protect yourself from the blows. But as they're beating you, they're smiling and saying to you, this is good for you. This is good for you. This is good for you. And there's just so many examples that I can give you, and I'm happy to. But it was just this weird feeling that you were always being beaten up day in, day out, and you're doing your best to try to prevent the blows. I always say it's like negotiating with a gun to your head. And one of the mistakes that was made by me and by others, and on this I don't beat myself up because I don't think it was really my responsibility. I don't think there was really a level of honesty that was passed on to Palestinians about what was happening. I think that all of these closed door negotiations, and they went wild to make sure that everything was behind closed doors. I think that all the closed door stuff was a disservice for people, because people were living a military occupation where it was clear that it was getting worse, and the Palestinian leadership was completely dishonest with what was actually happening behind closed doors.
I think it's really important to actually give examples and give a sense to our audience what was happening, not behind the secret doors that you all didn't know about, some of you didn't know about, but the negotiations that were happening. Because Palestinians are often blamed for, first of all, even having the conversations, but also for letting it happen. But for you, sitting in there, what are some examples that you can tell us?
Oh, gosh, so many. I'll give you a few that I hope illustrate what it was like. One example, so 2005, this is the period in which Israel's about to withdraw from the West Bank, right? It's what they call the disengagement. To give context, the disengagement was one-sided. Israel was going to withdraw. And there was a lot of pressure that was placed on the Palestinian Authority to sit with the Israelis and what they called coordinate the withdrawal. And what that meant is everything from how is it that the Israelis are going to leave? What are they going to leave behind? What are we going to do with the stuff that's left behind? What about security arrangements? Is there going to be a connection between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip? Is there going to be a seaport, an airport? Like, all of these issues were issues that we ended up having discussions about, or were supposed to have discussions about. There was a lot of money that was being earmarked for this disengagement, money that was going to go to the Palestinian Authority and money that was going to go to Israel as well. And one aspect that I think a lot of people don't really pay attention to is just how much Israel has made money off of this occupation, because it has. With that money that was going to be on the table, there was a demand that Israel coordinate with the Palestinian Authority. And on another level, we knew that they didn't want to coordinate anything. They wanted it to be that they pull out and that's it. That we knew that they wanted to create a level of chaos in Gaza, because this is the way that Israel operates, right? Like, they wanted all of that. So I'm telling you this background so that you understand this next piece of things. So in 2005, we spent 3.5 weeks negotiating over an agenda. What are we going to talk about was a 3.5 week negotiation, back and forth, hours a day. And then at one point in time, the World Bank had brought the Palestinian side and the Israeli Ministry of Defense with Shimon Peres. He was not the president at the time. And they brought us together and they said, okay, now we're going to iron out all of the issues in relation to how goods are going to get in and out of Gaza. Because remember, Gaza is under complete military blockade, complete siege. And it had been under this blockade, people often say 17 years, it's been actually since the 90s, whereby Israel checks what goes in and it checks what goes out. It has limits on what can go in. It has limits on what can go out. And a lot of it is tied to major Israeli business people, because again, occupation is corruption. And so this is a conversation I will never forget. So we were sitting in a room and we were negotiating over the mechanism by which goods were going to come in and goods were going to go out of the Gaza Strip. And the obvious is that it should be free flow of goods. Why does Israel get to control what goes into Gaza? Why does Israel get to control what comes out of Gaza? But yet there was always this sense that, no, we have to just abide by Israeli control. And so the conversation that I'll never forget was, we were talking about scanners and how they were going to scan the goods that were going to go into Gaza. And this Israeli Ministry of Defense, they call it defense, guy, he's a technocrat guy, looks at me straight-faced and says, the level of scanner and security that we need is so high that there actually isn't even a scanner that meets our requirements. Okay. This is what I mean by you're constantly just being beaten up. And nobody turns to him and says, huh? Nobody from the World Bank or the Americans, nobody says, okay, this is actually ridiculous. Nobody does any of that. And instead, they would say things like, we've made some good progress. And like, why? Because a guy said that there is no way on earth that we're going to ever let anything into Gaza. That's progress. But this is what I mean by the ways in which they behave. So that was one. Another example was in 2001 during Taba, where the Israelis had pulled out, they had a guy who was their map maker. And the guy who is making their maps is a settler. And so he presented a map of what was going to be the future Palestinian state. They never called it that. But he presented this map, and conveniently, the so-called boundary or border goes somewhat along the green line and then swoops 26 kilometers into the West Bank to take Ariel, which is a settlement that's located 26 kilometers into the heart of the West Bank, and then swoops back out again. And so there's all these Palestinian villages that are in between. And I looked at this guy and I said, okay. And he said, we have to abide by the Clinton parameter. And Clinton said that the Palestinian state is going to be roughly 90 some odd percent of the West Bank. And I said, okay, but why this area? And he said, because there's many people that live there like me. And I said, okay, but what about all the Palestinians who are there, right? But we were totally invisible to them. And again, the Americans say, oh, that was some real progress that we had there. And there were so many other things where Israeli negotiators would say things like, we will never abide by international law. What kind of law are you talking about? This is a joke. I have so many anecdotes, things like the times where they would hold up Palestinian negotiators at checkpoints for hours on end as they're on their way to a negotiation session. It's endless. There was never a time where I walked away and said there was actual progress made. It was a farce.
I have to ask, why didn't you all just walk away? Why didn't you all just remove yourselves from that space, avoid falling into their trap, essentially?
I did. And the others did not, I think for a few reasons, to be clear. This is not at all in defense of the PA. I just want people to understand the context. At a certain point in time, the Americans just kept putting more and more pressure on the Palestinian Authority and kept saying, this is it. We're not going to do anything. This is the only game in town. The mistake, obviously, on the part of the Palestinian Authority was not to create another scenario, right? Like to just simply abide by the Americans was the mistake. But the major Palestinian negotiators, they very much internalized it. And they fundamentally believed that they were weak, that there was nothing that could be done, and that they had to continue to abide by this. And when I questioned some of them, they would say, we actually did make progress in X, Y, and Z areas. Like, okay, but I wasn't there. Like, I didn't see any of it because I certainly did not see anything while I was there. The other problem, Zaina, was that for a period of time, there were no discussions. There were no negotiations. And when those were broken off was when my attention and the attention of a lot of other people actually turned more towards the issue of advocacy and diplomacy and media to try to get people to actually understand what was happening. So while there was a segment that still believed or was under the false illusion that they had no alternatives, there were others who had turned their sights elsewhere.
And just for our audience listening, obviously you have the ability to go live in Canada. You choose to live in Haifa.
Yeah.
And you obviously are seeing a lot of things and you're going through a lot of things constantly, as many Palestinians are. The question I get a lot of times from people who speak with me is the Palestinians that have the ability to leave, why do they stay? What would you say to that?
Because it's our homeland, because it's ours. And their dream is to see Palestinians leave. Look, we're in a situation now where we're battling against two things. And I'm not talking about land. It's the battle of fear and a battle of depression. And they want to depress us so badly that you leave. And they want to frighten us so much that you leave. I refuse to give them that. This is why, yes, it's difficult to live in Haifa. It's difficult to live amongst people who openly talk about genocide. That's not easy. It's difficult to be speaking out. And again, I don't want to make this about me, but for people who have spoken out, to have the police come down their throats, to be doxxed, to be threatened with rape, to be threatened with death, to have your neighbors come after you. It's not easy. It's not easy. And yet I continue to insist that we live and we live with joy because they won't take away my joy. I won't let them. I will not let them take away my joy. And my joy means that I live in my homeland, amongst my people, eating the food that my ancestors ate, amongst the trees that my ancestors planted. And we're holding on to it. We're doing our best to keep it as it is for when we see the day of liberation.
There's the transition between that sort of life of politics and negotiating on Palestine, and then your transition to your next phase of your life. How did that transition happen? What motivated you? What inspired you for the next steps?
There were a lot of next steps. One next step was legal, which we don't have to really get into. But the other next step, which was big for me, was leaving and not looking back. And that was born out of a real sense that this leadership is not doing anything and won't do anything. I remember just before I quit, people who work within the PA saying to me, no, don't quit. You can ask Abu Mazen Mahmoud Abbas to appoint you as ambassador to X country. And I remember saying, but then I have to represent Abu Mazen. And that's exactly what I don't want, because I lost all faith. And so I left and just left it like that. And it definitely wasn't easy, because not only is it leaving, but it's leaving. It's leaving, meaning that I had already been smeared enough by the Zionists everywhere I went, trying to find a job after having the job that I had and having the Zionist smear campaign was impossible. I was unemployed for quite some time, and I didn't mind. But it wasn't just that. It was that when I started to speak out against the Palestinian Authority, then it's another level of smear campaigns. And again, it's not been easy, but it is what it is.
Speaking of speaking out against the PA, again, I do have to ask, given the circumstances and what's happening right now in the past few years, we saw the murder of Nizar Banat. We saw the sort of attacks on the Palestinian people by the PA, now in Jenin, for, I lost track of the days between Gaza and Jenin. Doing the job of the occupation, what are your thoughts on that? Why is this happening? Why are they doing this? It's really, truly absurd. I don't even know how to ask this question, because we're watching it in complete disbelief. And the progression of where it started from the very beginning, we knew there's something off. But then the continuation of the PA's involvement in the oppression of their own people has now gotten to a level of not even absurdity. I really genuinely don't have the words for it. How do you attack your own people when you have an occupation attacking you? What are your thoughts?
Oh, where do I begin, Zaina? Where do I begin? I quit in 2005, and I stayed quiet until 2009. And the reason I stayed quiet was because we always have the, especially when you've lived outside and you know what it's like, you just think, oh, they're going to use it against us if you criticize the PA. And they will, and they will. But by 2009, particularly with the crushing of the Goldstone Report, that was when I decided I just can't stay silent any longer. I've got to critique this. And then from 2009 onwards, I've been pretty critical. I've written about it, etc. The Palestinian Authority, this was one of the reasons that I left. It's one thing for them not to devise an alternative strategy. It's another thing for them to internalize that they have to be Israel's security subcontractor. And that was the part that I couldn't take any longer. And that was the reason that I cannot do this any longer. And so how did we get to this point? In part because next week, Abu Mazen is going to be 20 years as president. He was elected for 4, all right? How did this happen? Because he's been allowed to stay in office for all of these years. And people give him a pass. And by people, again, I'm not talking about us, because we're stuck between the two fires, so to speak, a rock and a hard place. But others have. And so for him, he views that the survival, the very survival of us as a people is linked to the survival of the Palestinian Authority. And that the survival of the Palestinian Authority is linked to whether Israel likes the Palestinian Authority, whether Israel thinks that the PA is doing a good job. And so it's all connected. It's all connected. So why is he going after people in Jenin to now? Because I think he's been given orders to go after people in Jenin now. My fear, Zaina, is that this isn't just about Jenin. Nablus is next. Tul Kerem is next. Go down to Ramallah. Then down to Jericho and Beit Lahem and Qalil. You name it. That's the system that I see happening. And it's terrifying. It's terrifying. The idea that he's going after people in their own homes. What more can we say? What more can we say?
I mean, it feels like it's coordinated in a way where, I mean, and I don't want to belabor this point, but it feels like coordinated because they would attack Jenin, they would attack like Tul Kerem and Nablus surrounded by the PA. And it's just mind-blowing to me that they're holding a front for the Israelis as if in a really convoluted way. The progression of the reoccupation and annexation of the West Bank isn't new. It has been starting. This morning I was reading the news and they're moving the checkpoints closer and closer into the cities for security, as you had mentioned in your stories with the settlements. They're moving the checkpoints closer and closer because there are roads and settlements they need to protect. We're at a point that if it weren't so dangerous and awful, it would be comical, honestly. It's just weird how things have transpired.
And I don't presume you can answer this, but for Abu Mazen, knowing that he's quite literally killing his own people, that he is hurting his own people, again, you can't answer this, but I could never reconcile that. I wouldn't be able to get out of bed in the morning if I were doing that. It just doesn't make any sense to me. It doesn't compute whatsoever.
To get to the point where you kill somebody requires dehumanization, right? And othering. And so there was a phrase that they being the security apparatus of the Palestinian Authority, would use all the time, which they would repeat over and over again. And that is muharribin, the spoilers, the people who are trying to ruin things. It's not us. It's al-muharribin. It's the spoilers. It's the people who are doing harm. And so that's the way that he thinks of it. So for him, he thinks of it in terms of these are the people who are doing harm to the Palestinian cause. And that if we just get rid of the people who are doing harm, then all will be good. Obviously, that's false. Obviously, that's wrong, because the people who are doing harm are the Israelis. And so why isn't it that the energy is directed towards them rather than at our own people?
Yeah, and I think part of the conversation always has to be, and you did this perfectly, we always have to remember that all of it, the PA, Abu Mazen, what's happening, all of it is a product of 1948 Nakba, 1967, the settler colonial project in Palestine. We just heard about the ceasefire. This episode will air soon after. There's a lot of emotions, Diana. I have had a really hard time articulating how I'm feeling. It's a really weird mixture of happiness, but at the same time, there's so much pain and so much disillusionment. I don't believe them. I really don't. If it weren't for the beautiful faces of happy kids and families in Gaza after the announcement, I really would have not believed any of it. But like I said, hope endures. And this morning, Netanyahu was saying that he's not going to convene his cabinet or something along those lines because Hamas had done something, and he didn't say what it is. Where are your feelings on this?
All over the place. On the one hand, I'm elated. So I lived in Gaza for a year and a half. I lived with the drone for just a short period of time. I didn't endure it for more than, I think, a month. That drone makes you crazy. So people understand there's a 24-hour buzzing in Gaza because they're under 24-hour surveillance. All day, all night. It's a form of torture. And so I was elated because just this relief of not having bombs drop on your head, the relief of not hearing the drone, this huge relief, the ability for us to finally find my friends who are buried under the rubble and to be able to bury them with dignity, to be able to begin the process of grieving, to be able to try to come to terms with what Israel's done to us, to our kids, to the medical system that they've completely decimated, to being able to rebuild, clean out some of this rubble, go back home, be reunited with the people you love, sleep in a bed. These are all things that keep all of us obviously happy. And that's why we saw so much elation, because they survived, right? They survived genocide. And so that's obviously something that makes us very happy. And we as a people survived, that they didn't crush us, because that's what they wanted. Remember, what Israel said was that they were going to crush us. They were going to destroy and destroy. And this is what they've always said. And so we came out, we've survived, right? That's why people are happy. For example, I can't wait to see the joy on my best friend's face when she's reunited with her daughter. She's one of the prisoners that the Israelis have picked up and thrown in detention without charge, without trial. I can't wait for that moment. But then I also know that this wasn't, you know, Trump, the great deal maker. Netanyahu is being rewarded. He's going to be rewarded. And his reward is going to be that he can continue to control our lives, that he's going to continue to decimate Gaza. It's already been decimated. That he's going to steal the West Bank, that he's going to try to get normalized relations with the Arab world, that he's going to take Syrian territory. I know that he's going to be rewarded for this. So it's all mixed. And the one thing that I feel, Zana, the one thing is anger. I just cannot get rid of the anger. And I'm not an angry person. I cannot get rid of the anger because for so many reasons. One, that Israel has been allowed to carry out a genocide for 15 months. Two, that when I look at the terms of this agreement and the terms of the May 2024 agreement and the structure of the March of 2024 agreement, they're identical. So the only difference between May and today was that he killed 20,000 more people and destroyed the medical system. And I'm angry that the world has done nothing despite us doing everything. We broadcast our own genocide. We use the legal system. We went and appealed to people nationally and internationally. We had, and you all were involved, sustained protest. We were going and doing all the things that we're supposed to do. And the world, the Western world, still hates us. That's the part that makes me just really angry, and that Israel hasn't paid a price. So it's mixed. It's all mixed emotions. It's everything from happiness to fear to anger to hope to pride. It's all mixed.
It's mind-blowing to me watching all these politicians, and especially this administration, taking pride and credit in a ceasefire that they have accomplished. And that aspect of it really nauseates me. It's quite guttural. It's visceral. I can't get over the fact that they caused all this death and destruction and then have the audacity to stand there and demand praise for their role. You had said in an interview when you were asked about the UN and UNRWA that Israel is, and I'm quoting here, getting rid of the eyes and ears of the international body that is a witness to its war crimes. Add to that what we have seen, like the lack of movement of the ICC and ICJ. More than ever now there has been, but still we haven't seen an enforcement of the resolutions. We haven't seen any kind of real sense of an enforcement of a ceasefire by the international community. We were talking about accountability. Where do you see accountability come from? Because of the disillusionment in the international system, where is accountability going to come from? It's definitely not coming from the Western world. How do you see it happening?
On this, I'm a little optimistic, I have to say. And I'll explain why. We might not see accountability in the way that you and I want to see it. It might not be that we see Netanyahu in prison, although he should be in prison. He's a war criminal and Gallant is a war criminal and so many of them are war criminals. But Israeli soldiers now are starting to feel the heat. And they live in a world, this is why I said my life changed after I learned that language. I don't know if you all saw the film Zone of Interest. So Zone of Interest is about, during the Holocaust, people who are living next to a concentration camp and they just continue their lives as though nothing has happened. For Palestine, it's not Zone of Interest. It's worse than that. It's like they are living knowing and they're living with glee. So now Israeli soldiers are not living with glee. They're having to really question, where am I going to travel? What am I going to do? And so the TikToks that they were posting, by the way, a lot of them were being posted so they could get dates. The TikToks that they were posting, the macho poses for Tinder and all of that in their uniforms as they're blowing up Palestinian houses, etc. It's coming down on them. And Israelis are now beginning to feel just how much the world is not cool with genocide. So it's starting to happen. And I think that we're right at the beginning of it. And then I think it's going to be what Israel is, which is a house of cards. I think it's all going to crumble very quickly. Again, I don't think it's going to happen in the ways that you and I would love it to happen, which is that he flies to some country and then the country grabs him and then they try him and they throw him and you see him being tried before The Hague. But I do think there's other things that are happening. I do see that there's a global movement for boycott. I do see that there's a global movement that is pushing to hold these individual soldiers accountable. I do think that there is going to be a change. And once people see the scope of this genocide. Remember, a lot of it has been shielded. The Israelis have not let foreign journalists in. Not that they need to be let in. We've already seen images. But when the truth of it comes out, I think we're going to be hard-pressed to find people who are supportive of this genocide. Everybody's going to become a revisionist and say, oh, no, I was opposed from the beginning. I do think that it's going to change. I really do. And as I was saying, they want to scare us and they want to depress us. I just refuse to buy into either of those.
We are out of time, but I want to remind you that it does take a village to produce a show like This Week in Palestine. Special thanks to Mohammed Al-Ghul and Bob Funk, with additional thanks to Stan Robinson and Steve Lowe. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, currently at the home of WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. As always, we thank you for spending your time with us today as we continue to work towards Palestinian liberation. See you next week. Thank you.